Madame la présidente de séance.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Workers' Representative, Vice Chair, Employers' Representative, Director General. Mr. Guy Ryder, members of the governing body, colleagues who are present in great number today in this room, or those who are connected, the 300 or so who are connected online. At the outset, I would like to thank you for giving me the floor at this governing body. I know that your time is precious, that the agenda is full for this day of the governing body following a conference that concluded after many long days and nights of work. We certainly share the feeling of fatigue and the desire to return to our families and loved ones, and I hope also to return to our colleagues who share our professional day-to-day life. We have experienced unique moments together, which may seem to exist outside of time, but which have enabled us to achieve together once again progress in key areas for the world of work. I would like to thank you personally and on behalf of the 3,600 colleagues whom I represent. The presence of many of them today is testament to the fact that they want to be heard and that the reality of staff members must be taken into account in your upcoming discussion on document GB354 INS 5, entitled The ILO in a Changing Multilateral Environment, Towards Better Effectiveness and Efficiency. As we know, it is not standard practice for the staff union to take the floor at June meetings of the governing body. Exceptional times call for exceptional measures. We have to confront together a concerning reality. The last time I took the floor in March of this year, I shared with you the importance of trust. Trust that is necessary for us to be effective craftsmen of social justice, each of us with our respective tasks and responsibilities. This trust is hardly arbitrary. It is rooted in respecting universal human rights, in respecting international labour standards, and in respecting social dialogue. This trust should enable us to reinvent together the best way to promote social justice so that the ILO is capable of delivering on the legitimate expectations from the world of work, and so that people remain at the heart of our work and our commitments. This reinvention cannot take place through hasty, unilateral measures, measures that are against the staff members who themselves will be the ones implementing these decisions. It demands time and trust. Distinguished members of the governing body, this trust has been sorely tested in the current context of uncertainty, with many of our bearings being shaken and a pace of change across the world that is stepping up. This trust, unfortunately, seems to be giving way today to anxiety and the desire to take rushed decisions to deal with emergencies and to take decisions of which we have no control. Since March, we have had to implement measures to assist our colleagues whose projects were brought to an end from one day to the next. I'm referring to 150 colleagues who have been laid off to date from Mexico to Fiji, Vietnam, Myanmar, Kenya, Brazil, Ghana, Costa Rica, Nigeria, Indonesia, Haiti, Tanzania, Lebanon, Thailand, Egypt, China, Peru, Turkey, Nepal, Armenia, Bangladesh, Philippines, Mauritania, Sri Lanka, the DRC, Chile, Pakistan, Lesotho, Côte d'Ivoire, Geneva, and Malaysia. This is 8% of all of the staff who learned so suddenly of the end of their projects on which they were working. These projects worked to promote fundamental labor rights, to eliminate child labor, to eliminate trafficking in persons. They provided technical support to promote and strengthen freedom of association and to promote the ratification and establishment of ILO conventions. These colleagues now find themselves unemployed without social protection nets because they are without unemployment insurance mechanisms or any other social security systems. And in some cases, they are now without residence permits in the places where they were brought to settle for work. These colleagues don't know what their life is going to look like. They are frightened by the limited prospects of finding a job on a labor market in the development sector, which is collapsing with the entire United Nations system being called into question so profoundly. These are colleagues for whom the conditions of their layoffs and other legal issues are still open even after they have left their jobs. These layoffs, well, they also mean a number of commitments and goals that have been set with our constituents and which will no longer be achieved because it is impossible to meet the demand for expertise when experts are no longer here. Okay, so be it. We have done our best, and that is from the administration side of things. So I'd like to thank many of the managers and colleagues mobilized from the Department of Human Resources and Finances, but also in terms of on the union side of things, by representatives who have proven the importance of solidarity and goodwill. But that is far from being sufficient. We were saddened and appalled to hear the news from other United Nations system agencies when we learned of mass layoffs without these staff members having a safety net and without real consultations with the staff representative bodies. We are losing colleagues and sometimes friends with whom we have worked for a long time. Let's be clear, the lack of labor rights and true social dialogue in these agencies is also our collective failure. Since March, we have had to engage in a process of revision, which is presented in the document that is under discussion today. Allow me, ladies and gentlemen, members of the governing body, to get straight to the point. This document is not the result of consultations, and it is not the result of a process of social dialogue with the staff union. Since the beginning of the process for drafting proposals, the Director General, it is true, reaffirmed his desire to engage in consultations with staff and to consult or negotiate with the union where necessary. The union was therefore consulted on immediate cost-saving measures, which were communicated to staff on the 16th of May. The union shared a number of questions regarding the implementation of certain measures, and as is the case with staff, we are still awaiting clarification on this. These are questions concerning the scope of these measures, as we have some doubts on the adaptability for our operations on the ground and for the provision of our technical assistance, as well as on the real impact in terms of savings and efficiency. The union also stood ready to negotiate as swiftly as possible on measures for changing staff status or collective agreements in order to respond to the needs that have been stated by the administration. Negotiations are therefore underway on modalities that will enable us to better optimize our premises, to revise the travel policy, and on specific measures that will have a direct impact on our working conditions. However, we are still questioning their true objective and their real contribution to the need to make savings. Other measures introduced by the office to improve the effectiveness and efficiency in its functioning contained in the document on the agenda today have not been the subject of consultations and even less so negotiations. The Union discovered this document the day before it was published, and we have discovered through articles in the media and from rumors and whisperings the potential places where some of us may be called to move, perhaps. This document that is now presented to you has taken us by surprise, because the deadline that was set to propose to you solutions rooted in collective bargaining was for November of this year. Therefore, we established our process for consultations with staff members accordingly, so that without rushing, we would be able to propose solutions to best respond to the needs of the moment, while staying the course when it comes to our shared goal, which is to promote social justice with quality services that are adapted to your needs. Our ambition is to define together what these efficiency gains may actually be and how we can measure them, and to root our proposals in shared understanding, and to really understand what this efficiency that is so sought after is through precise cost-benefit analysis, and to also make a distinction between short, medium, and long-term financial constraints, and to make a distinction between temporary measures and necessary structural reform. And so we would have liked to pose questions on measures to decentralize services towards cheaper countries, which for the time being are not actually based on any real figures. And the same goes for the intention to make savings by getting rid of costly staff members, rather than looking at the added value that our colleagues with decades of experience can provide to the quality of services offered. And we would also like to pose questions on the implications for vulnerable staff members of the ILO, for example, our colleagues with disabilities, our colleagues from the LGBTIQ community, and our colleagues with specific family responsibilities who need quality of life and professional life that enables them to be respected and their demands are taken into account. The ILO aims to be the precursor of diversity and inclusion, and so it needs to give itself the means to actually fulfill that role. For the Union, in this negotiation, we want to give priority to efficiency rather than to cutting jobs, and to the quality of services rather than making short-term savings, and above all, we want to make sure that this is people-centred. Local colleagues, who represent 47% of the staff funded from the regular budget, which includes 300 staff members in Geneva, cannot be relocated unless their job is requalified into an international contract, with many questions on legal modalities and the financial impacts that will ensue as a result of that. Let me make myself clear. Relocation will not save all jobs, and those most affected will be local colleagues whose fate is so uncertain. And we should also note that the forced mobility of international staff goes against staff regulations. Moving to other countries would therefore mean that we would be going against not just our current rules, but also the mobility policy that we have just renegotiated in 2025, with an approach for negotiations based on shared interests and that is designed to improve and promote better staff mobility. The risk of choosing one department or another to relocate without even agreeing on the criteria for such selection runs counter to the very principles of justice and equity on which this process should be based. Arbitrariness should never be the solution. We also would have liked to put onto the table proposals that have come from a consultation process with staff members, and thereby giving the Union a mandate for negotiations that would enable us to move forward on the basis of shared interests and through principles that are well defined by all of the colleagues whom I represent, and which would give value to our deep knowledge of the nuts and bolts of the organisation, its disadvantages, the parts we should keep, and the innovations that we should be promoting. And we could have expressed our concern as regards the proposal for an alignment of principles with the United Nations Secretariat, which could lead to a race to the bottom with working conditions that are more precarious and a loss of expertise from the office. Yes, we are privileged. However, the current context shows how much the structural problems linked to our contractual policies leads to a precarious and fragile situation. We would like to call on the office to reaffirm its responsibility to set an example across the entire United Nations system and beyond when it comes to labor rights, organizational integrity, contractual policy, inclusion, and collective bargaining. This is a condition for the quality of future services that we will be capable of providing, but above all, an alignment with our highest values of decent work and social justice. To those who might think that the United Nations system agencies would be capable of defending a part of the ILO mandate as part of the UN 80 reform, where responsibilities will be mixed and redistributed, I would ask them to look very carefully at the dismissal conditions that are currently being applied without any regard for rights and standards. These arbitrary actions that are very regrettable disqualify the potential ambitions that these agencies may have to become the depositaries and defenders of a part or all of the standards of our organization. I hope that Mr. Ryder will be able to assure you in the upcoming hour on the respect for the principles of social dialogue, and that he will be able to provide some clarification on the processes underway and their implication for such a specialized agency as the ILO. Members of the governing body, we hope that it is not too late to ask all of these questions. On the basis of the guidance that you will provide to the office under the discussion of this agenda item, it is vital that the office does not present the union and the staff that we represent with a fait accompli of a mandate that we think we have received, but without being able to really conduct internally consultations and negotiations. I'm stating to you very solemnly, we will continue to provide our support to the administration for proposed measures that will give us the means to be more effective in our work and in respecting these rights and social dialogue. But we will oppose by all means necessary measures that will affect jobs and working conditions for our colleagues if these measures are rushed and do not have any clearly identified advantages. The union remains faithful to the principles of managing change, which are the subject of joint guidelines as part of our bipartite collective bargaining committee, which states that change and restructuring are often the opportunity to improve the organization of work and the content of jobs and to modify roles and responsibilities. However, change and restructuring can also have an impact on the stability of relations between staff and management, and may raise concerns among staff people affected by these changes or restructuring. And so these guidelines highlight the importance of having an approach that optimizes the interests of the staff and of the office. Members of the governing body, make no mistake, the staff members are not refusing change as such. Moreover, for 2 weeks now, we have been reiterating that we want to contribute to solutions to deal with the current context that we know is difficult and uncertain, and that is calling into question the very principles of multilateralism. We have also demonstrated with conviction our faith rooted in the values of social dialogue. As an elected representative of this historic union, that is the ILO staff union, I have no other choice but to continue to fight so that the forum of social dialogue and collective bargaining is respected internally. And in this uncertain context, this is the pillar that I must rely on. And this is not just in the interest of the staff, but also in the interest of the organization, which is as much yours as it is ours, and for which I have worked with passion and dedication for the past 24 years. I took the commitment before my colleagues that as president of the union, I would remain faithful to its values and principles, and that as part of this framework, which has been patiently drafted over the course of our shared history and fine-tuned by my predecessors, I would make progress. And I also took the commitment before the governing body, and I hope that this will be a reciprocal commitment which will underpin every stage of the months to come. We have a shared responsibility to demonstrate that even during crises, any negotiated solution is not perfect, but it is the best option. I hope that at the next governing body meeting in November, we together can be proud, and we will be able to note that this founding principle, social dialogue, is not reduced to nothing, but that it will have, on the contrary, enable our organization to set measures which will enable us to get out of this crisis more resilient, stronger, and more effective, so that we can fulfill the mandate that you give to it. Thank you for your attention.